Well, no matter what the season, there are countless insects around us. And whether we're talking about mosquitoes, moths, box elder bugs, or millipedes, it's always a fascinating and informative conversation. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm in for Larry Mueller. He's still a little bit under the weather. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri is our guide to insects today, and he helps us to figure out what we're dealing with and what to do about it, if anything. Phil is a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. He retired as head of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. What insects have you noticed around so far? Are there more or less of any particular type than you'd expect? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jill.
How are you today?
Doing well. Doing real well.
Excellent. You didn't get too much damage with the hail, did you?
No. Was watching it nervously, but I could, it was not near as bad as I have seen in years past. So.
Oh, my gosh. Some people really got hit, literally, with some of that. That was bad. So I'm glad you escaped. So, let's talk about tent caterpillars. I mean, some of those tents might have got hit by some of that hail. But for those who haven't seen them, what does a tent caterpillar look like? Well, what does their tent look like, I should say?
We're about 2 weeks away from it really catching your attention.
Okay.
And what it is the eggs are on twigs, and it's kind of like a little swelling or a piece of tape almost. It looks bubbly if you look at it. And they hatch just about the time the plants start to leaf out. And this particular species attacks flowering fruit trees. So you're talking cherries, apples, and the like.
Mm-hmm.
For the next 4 to 5 weeks, the caterpillars will feed, and the tent can get as big as 2 feet wide and, a foot long, filled with literally dozens of caterpillars. But the issue is the quicker you get after it, if you need to, the easier. You can hand scrape it. You can even crush it in your hand. You can spray it with soapy water. That works well. Where it often happens is when they're finishing up, and they might have even stripped all the leaves off the tree, and you see this quite commonly in the woods in wild cherry and the like. They migrate off, spin their cocoons down, and that's all you see. And the plants are defoliated, but the interesting thing for most of those plants is they will leaf out and be just fine by the middle of summer. So it's something that visually bothers you quite a bit, but it really isn't very serious. On the other hand, as I said, knowing that now is when they hatch, you go up and examine the plants and you see little webby type things, you can deal with it very easily.
Okay. So you said these are like 4 feet long and they're filled with caterpillars and you want me to go up to them and pull them down?
But it's a loose. It looks like a giant spider web.
Okay.
That's the best way to describe it. And yeah, the worms. Honestly, as worms go, are attractive because they got these really nice blue lines down the back and the like. And then because entomologists are confusing people, there's something called a forest tent caterpillar.
Uh huh.
That looks very similar. It eats different plants, but it doesn't make a tent. Imagine that.
Okay.
And forest tent caterpillar is more northern Wisconsin. We do get outbreaks where it will defoliate popples and the like. That more goes on a cycle. You really don't see it every year. It tends to build over, a 7 to 8 year period of time and then disappears kind of on its own because of natural parasites.
Mm-hmm.
But the eastern tent caterpillar is throughout the state. And as I said, if you've had a history of problems before on some of your fruit trees and the like, next 10 days or so, I would go out and take a look. For a big tree that is way up there, it's not worth the bother. As I said, it really is cosmetic, but it definitely catches your attention.
Okay, so don't worry about them unless you don't like it, because it's not going to hurt. Is it going to hurt the fruit, though? I mean, is it going to hurt the blossoms?
Well, the argument is if they defoliate the tree, they will weaken it enough that it'll affect your fruit production next year.
Next year.
It's not as if they're totally, but it really is more of a stressor on the tree because the tree is losing all its leaves. It has to put new leaves out, and that costs it energy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that it's totally harmless, but as I said, I've always found it to be far more visually upsetting than it really is for the plant.
Sure. Now, do these caterpillars, and I'm assuming they turn into a butterfly of some sort or a moth or what have you?
Yeah, a small moth that literally will come out and lay its eggs towards the end of summer, and then it gets through the winter as that egg mass and starts mm-hmm. everything for next year.
And is this food for birds?
Oh, definitely.
Okay,
definitely.
So got to think about it that way. They're not hurting anything. They're food for birds, so...
Right. Well, and especially, as I said, you see these in fence rows and whatnot, and you drive down the interstate, you can tell the plants are infested. But, yeah, those kind of things, you just let it run its course.
Okay. Well, that's a good reason for not taking them down. All right. Well, we have a call already, so let's go to John in Appleton. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. I have, and thanks for taking my call. I have an issue with these black flies that they show up in, like, the first really warm, sunny day in spring. And, like, the grass is just full of them, and they're up along my garage door. And, you know, and in the past, I haven't really done anything. And then in the fall, they show up again. And recently, I've had them in my house, and I think they're in my double-hung windows. They crawl in there and nest, and then they reemerge in late fall. And I'm wondering, is there any strategy for trying to mitigate them? Because once they're in the house, it's horrible.
So it sounds like what we would call a cluster fly. And cluster flies' habit is in the fall of the year, usually in September, they look for shelter. In natural settings, they would do this in caves and tree bark and the like. But if they get access to your house, whether through the attic or into wall voids and the like, then you suffer the whole year. In warm days in January, we'll have a couple wake up. And then when we finally do get in the warm weather, you know, insects like this cannot function below 50 degrees. So when things warm enough on the wall to get a move, and that's when they come out and cause the problem. It's interesting your observation about them along the side of the house and in the grass. It sounds like they're finding a lot of overwintering sites that don't have access to the house. But when you look at their life cycle in the spring of the year, don't bother. In the fall of the year, that's the time to stop them. And it's one of two things. The best way is if you can physically figure how they're getting in and seal it. Sometimes that's easy. You know, if they're only in a bathroom, it turns out it could be the bathroom vent fan that's not screened properly, and that's an access point for the critters. In an old house, though, there's often so many different places that they can squeeze into, but it's well worth the physical barriers to keep them out, because then you're done. The other alternative is there are sprays that can be put on the outside of the house in September to kill them before they get in. In September is critical. Maybe first week of October in some years, but the thing is, if you start noticing them in the house in November, they're in the walls, you can't touch them, and so don't bother. You know, get the vacuum cleaner out or whatever else you need to do. So that would be the strategy. Let them run their course. They are parasites of earthworms by nature. They're not native to Wisconsin. They're a European species, but they've been here for hundreds of years. And so you tend to see a little bit of a relationship in wet years where there's lots of worms, there's lots of cluster flies. In very dry years where the worm populations crash, that often results in far less flies. But that being said, if you've had a place that's had a history of problems, as I said, either you build them out as best you can by caulking and screening and filling, you know, holes. They like to get on the sunny side of the house and crawl upwards. So sometimes it's worth getting real low and looking up to see if you can see the cracks and crevices that they're sneaking into. And especially the south side of the house, because that would tend to be the sunniest, is the one I would pay the most attention to.
Okay, thank you, John. Appreciate the call. That goes for a lot of those insects that get into our house, doesn't it, Phil?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting in new houses where they use some of this house wrap and whatnot for energy efficiency. It also tends to make it much more difficult for critters to get in. On the other hand, sometimes people forget by design, and so some of the soffits, you know, they're loosely placed on, and in if you can squeeze your finger through a crack, there's all kinds of insects that can get access. So as I said, it sometimes just you kind of put your thinking cap on, and you know, I wish we would see this a little bit more out of the pest control industry, that they would have. I know people in that industry that are experts in understanding how buildings are made, and they're very good at what we call proofing, and they do this for mice too. And you know, they build things out if you understand the dynamics. But oftentimes, so you know, I like that solution better than I do the sprays. But as I said, there are definitely situations where you can't seal things up enough. But if you've got your walls open, as I said, this would be a case of thinking about some of that house wrap as a way of both energy efficiency, but more importantly, from my standpoint, is keep the critters out.
Okay. Now let's talk about sawflies. Now, this is the time of year that we're going to see a lot of critters on trees, shrubs, etc. Which ones can create a lot of problems for us? The sawflies, scale insects, you know, what have you. What are the worst ones we should be looking for?
Well, you know, again, I think about the spring and things come on. There are different species of sawflies. Most of them are very host-specific. But in the spring, we have a European pine sawfly that attacks Mugel pines, which is a common ornamental, Austrian pines, and the like. And this is another one of those insects that is basically hatched just about the time that the new growth starts. What that particular critter does, interesting enough, it only feeds on the old growth, not the new growth. There's differences in the chemistry of the leaves. But, boy, they can strip the devil in their little green worms on green needles, so they're not the most visible critters until, again, they often have done their damage. So this is another one of those cases where it's almost worth keeping a diary as a gardener.
If
insects have got the better of you, you know, is remind yourself to go out and look at the pines. And if you see a cluster, and it is always a cluster, the attack is a colony of little green worms. I said you can spray them with soapy water or physically remove them before they can do their damage. One that is causing me frustration is I have some azaleas in my backyard, and there is a little green worm called an azalea sawfly that shows up, and that little stinker eats all the leaves off. It leaves the flowers alone, and it always feels like it happens overnight. You know, the plants look good, and you come back a day or two later, and most leaves are chewed on and the like. Again, knowing that they are very easy to predict by timing, I go out there and if I see they start to cause problems, then I usually will do something to get rid of them.
And what's the best way to get rid of those?
Well, you've got options. Sawflies, interesting enough, they look like caterpillars, but they're not. They're really in the wasp and hornet group.
Oh.
Why that's important is one of the bacterial insecticides, which is organic, the BT products that we would use on our cabbage to stop the little green worms and whatnot, is not effective against sawflies because it's a different kind of critter. But they are susceptible to soapy water. Spinosad is an organic product that kills worms quite well, and there's a lot of, you know, Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew and other commercial names for these products. That would be an option, as would many of the standard garden insecticides. They're not hard to kill. It's just a question of getting after them. And as I said, little green worms on leaves are easily overlooked until they've done quite a bit of damage. And what happens when an insect grows like that is they eat 2 to 3 times their body weight a day. And so when they're little worms, that's not much. When they get towards the end of their life cycle, it gets very dramatic.
Oh, yes, for sure. Well, we are talking about insects today with Phil Pelletieri, an entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus of UW-Madison. And we're going to be back right after the news. So stick around and give us a call with your questions or send an email. We'll be right back. We are talking about insects on the Larry Mueller Show today. I'm Jill Nadeau. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri is our guest. He is a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. And Phil, we've got our phone lines filled. So let's just go right over there. Ravenwind in Washburn has been waiting for a while. Go right ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about cluster flies. I'm sitting and looking out my kitchen window, and there's cluster flies all over the glass. And I have always noticed that when they die on glass, they leave like a little cloud behind. And I'm wondering why that is.
I would be suspicious that they are dying of a fungus disease. To be honest, fungi cause a lot of death in insect populations. And when they die, like same with our, you know, diseases on our plants, the fungus sends out spores. And so you get this little kind of white powdery stuff. If it seemed more liquidy, you know, then I would say it's just their body fluids. You know, they're inactive all winter long. The body fluids accumulate the waste products, and they expel that when they move out. But as I said, if it looks on either on the webby side or more dusty side, I wonder, again, if it's just a fungus disease. Now, in some cases, that fungus disease could be more secondary, more of a decaying process than it is lethal. But there's definitely a lot of it's interesting when I see wet springs, aside from being happy for my garden, I think about wet springs tend to promote a lot of natural insect diseases, and particularly the fungi.
Okay, thank you for that call. Let's go to Anne Marie in South Milwaukee. Go right ahead.
Hello, I have a question about bee houses. A neighbor took down some tree pieces and cut them in nice little branches about 3 inches wide and maybe a foot tall. And I want to drill holes in them and make bee houses. And I'm wondering, A, if I should make the holes different sizes, and B, because I have quite a few of them, like how many could I string together? And I have a wrought iron, like, porch fencing, and, like, I could just hook them up on the porch, and I was wondering how close I could put them together and how close I can make, like, the holes also.
Sure. Well, you know, I think a diversity in sizes is good because you attract different species. You know, certain species have kind of size requirements, and so, again, by varying it, you will attract some. You've probably seen on the Internet pictures of these incredible bee hotels that are both good for the insects but also very artsy in the like. And so there's so many different ways of doing it. How successful it will be has a lot to do with what your native bee populations are like. But the longer that stuff is around, the better. So I'd say, you know, do whatever you want. If they don't all get used the first year, indeed they could be in used in future years. It's not like you can overdo it, I guess, other than for aesthetic reasons. But as far as the insect populations, no, it won't hurt at all. You know, you've got leafcutter bees, and again, 200 different species of native bees running around. A lot of them utilize these kind of settings, like hollow pith inside certain plants naturally. And what you're doing is providing that environment by drilling holes into the wood.
Yeah, good for you, Anne Marie. And I've seen a lot of how-tos videos out there on the internet, so maybe you want to do a little bit of searching for those. So good luck with that. Let's go to Roy in Whitewater. Go ahead, Roy.
Hi. I'm wondering if you have a prediction on the gypsy moth, spongy moth infestation this year. I had a couple of years where it was very aggressive. The last 2 years, virtually nothing. Supposedly, the wet and cold spring kills them off with a virus and a fungus. We've certainly had a wet spring so far here in southeastern Wisconsin. I'm not sure if it's been cold enough. Do you think we're going to see yet another remission?
Well, we're heading that way. In your observation, you know, we had a couple dry years, and their population really built. And then the last couple springs in particular have been wet. What is critical, they're hatching right now, but we're going to see more of the benefit of the high moisture levels is what's going to happen in the next 2 to 3 weeks. But I think going into the spring, the populations are down just because of what has happened before. And as I said, to really get problematic, what it seems to be is you need 3, sometimes 4 dry years in a row for them to build up to the point that they just explode. And you know, that being said, what's good about it being so wet now, it would be nice if it continued for at least a couple weeks, because as he said, it has more impact on the middle-sized caterpillars than it does the real tiny ones. Although the kind of rains we've been having in the state literally washes a lot of these little insects off the plants, and that also is going to knock their populations down.
Okay, thank you, Roy. Let's go to Bruce in La Crosse.
Yes, good afternoon. Phil, I've been listening to you for a long time with Larry, and I appreciate your work. I've got a starburst locust that every winter receives just a ton of woodpecker damage, and again, this year it did it again. Started treating it with Transect some years ago, and at least now, whatever bugs are in there do not affect the greening leaves as they would shrivel up prior to use of Transect. I was told by a arborist that the Transect should only have to be used 1 or 2 times and we would take care of this. But again, this year, the entire trunk and upper branches are pecked. In some cases, I may even lose a branch or two. What do you think?
Does it remind you all of sapsucker type feeding where it's just very extensive, or is it more random patterns when they feed on things?
No, it's random patterns, and it's a variety of woodpeckers. I can watch them all winter long.
Wow, that's fascinating. Only, you know, I'm familiar with the borers on locust in particular, and either they win or lose, you know, to continue to have the tree grow with that much insect activity. And, of course, the insect activity brings the birds in. So, yeah, I'm a little surprised at the intensity in a short period of time. And definitely with them working, you know, would suggest that there's beetle larvae underneath the bark and that the transect didn't take care of all of it, unfortunately. How old's the tree?
For many years now, this will be probably the fifth or sixth year that I've been using it. And when I do use it, you know what I'm saying, where the leaves will roll up in the new mm-hmm. in the new foliage? Well, if I use the transect, the leaves don't roll up, but the trunk is completely scarred.
Hmm.
An arborist told me that this could be what he called a midge.
There are leaf midges. Right off the top of my head, I don't remember them being really common on locust. But you know, those are little maggot-like critters that are inside the leaves. And yes, they will cause a puckering or a swelling. But I cannot see where the woodpeckers would have any kind of interest. You know, other kinds of birds might forage on something like, you know, woodpeckers. It's all about usually various kinds of bark beetles and the like that are working under the trunk. And you know, they can sense that pretty well. And it tells you the tree is highly stressed to have that kind of borer population.
Yeah, I would be concerned about that tree, don't you think, Phil?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things, if you do lose a branch or branches come down, I think it's worth peeling the bark back as best you can. Sometimes you can call exactly what insect it is by the design of the trails underneath the bark. And that would be well worth taking a picture and maybe send it off to PJ to see if he can give you a little bit more. Because like I said, the normal locust borers that I'm familiar with, there's a great big one that is more common on black locust. And that one, you know, it's big and dramatic, but it really doesn't cause the problems. The one that really is more of a concern are the small metallic wood borers related to chestnut borer and bronze birch borer and whatnot. Well, there's one on locust. And usually what we see trees, because of construction damage or two or three years of repeated drought, the trees get weakened enough, the borers move in, and unfortunately, you know, they can take the tree out. But those conditions often change, you know, again, and with the kind of moisture levels we got, you can't argue it's been drought the last couple of years, which would mean if the tree has survived it, it should be able to grow past it. Mm-hmm. So they said, I'm a little confused at the intensity over a period of time of borer activity you've had in the tree. And definitely your observation. I mean, this is the same with emerald ash borer. You know that ash trees have the problem because the trees get debarked quite quickly, and that, you know, the birds sense it often before you can see visual symptoms on the tree.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Bruce. I don't know. I think I would have an arborist look at that tree if I were you.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Let's go to emails. Dennis in Two Rivers emailed us. He's heard honeybee populations are declining, and if someone makes hotels for other bee species, would it be beneficial to move occupied hotels to croplands?
Well, you know, it turns out that some crops like alfalfa do not use honeybees as their pollinator. They use leafcutter bees.
Mm-hmm.
And the same when you've ever traveled up in Canada where they grow canola and you see all these funny little tents out in the field, those are, again, for a type of leafcutter bee they use for pollinating plants and the like. And so, yes, it is used. It's much more difficult and labor-intensive to get these bee populations built up and then have to transport them and the like. So it is used. But not near as, I mean, the thing that makes honeybees so easy to work with is the way their colonies go. They overwinter in big numbers and the like, and you can easily move the boxes. That's why, you know, people have depended on them as being our main pollinators, whereas the native bee populations have always been more related to what kind of environments are around, what kind of habitat is around for them. And that's what the idea of these bee houses are, that, you know, you are creating habitat that may not normally be in your backyard, and all of a sudden the bees can take advantage of it, and you're promoting your population of native bees.
Have you heard much about bee populations? How that it's always up and down, so it's hard to keep track.
Yeah, it was not the best year the last couple of years, and it turned out what it is that the varroa mite, which is one of the relatively new parasites, is become resistant to some of the treatments. The varroa mite introduces viruses into the bee population, and so that, at least in the last couple of years, has been why there have been more than normal problems. It's just been, in my career, a litany of parasites and diseases that have come in and threatened. And, you know, thank goodness, they breed bees like we do livestock. And so the bee breeders do work quite a bit at trying to come up with resistant lines. And we've had some success with that.
Yeah. And speaking of pollinators and ups and downs, what's going on with monarchs? Last I heard that it's been a good year for monarchs.
Yeah, well, you know, in our household, my wife has taken over raising monarchs.
Oh, has she?
Last year we released something like 35 just from our butterfly weed in our gardens. That
was
fun. And, you know, the neighborhood kids could come and enjoy it. You know, it's always so dependent on how well things go for the winter down in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're into that migratory phase. And so you keep your fingers crossed. And, you know, the one thing is, you know, you almost have to look at a bigger picture sometimes, because what we witness in Wisconsin may or may not be what's happening elsewhere. But as I said, it was the best monarch year I remember for rearing monarchs in the last 10 years here. And so I'm glad to hear that there was no catastrophes in Mexico, because, as I said, the weather patterns down there, I think, have as big an impact as anything as far as what's going to happen.
It seems to be. What about other butterflies? You know, I was at the dog park about a month ago, and I thought I was seeing things when I saw a butterfly, and there was snow on the ground. I didn't realize that we had early butterflies. What can you tell me about that?
Well, the ones I've been seeing most commonly in the last week or two are the little white cabbage butterflies that attack your broccoli. But the ones that you probably saw are things like painted ladies in mourning cloaks. There are species of butterflies that overwinter as adults, especially mm-hmm. the mourning cloaks.
Yeah, it was a mourning cloak.
Tree bark and during the tree bark and whatnot in shelter places, and you get the right conditions, a warm day where they can warm up over 40, 45 degrees, and those dark bodies that they have allow them to sun themselves and get their body temperature up, and then they can be active. And it's almost like turning a light on and off. Now, unfortunately, if too much of that happens, in January, then you're waking things up and they got to find a new shelter before to get through the next 6 weeks type of thing. But I think they've adapted pretty well. As I said, I have not seen a whole lot of those activity, but, you know, you can find mosquitoes in January under the right circumstances, because of the same thing, is there are some species that overwinter as adults, and that's what we're seeing.
Yes, for sure. Well, it was a lovely thing to see, and I tried to I tried to chase it to get a picture because I wasn't sure. Well, of course, I couldn't. But a friend of mine actually saw one, took a picture, so that I was able to identify it. So, yes, I wasn't seeing things. So that's a good thing. So Barbara emailed us, and she noticed some large anthills in her yard. And without digging up the lawn, is there a safe treatment insecticide that she could use that will not poison birds?
Okay, so most of our ant species, especially our native ant species, there is a single queen. And the whole secret of controlling ants is to find the nest and kill the queen. The problem is those big ones. And if I had to guess, these are probably what we call field ants. And there are a number of species. They make the big mounds. The colonies can live for 10 to 12 years. Sometimes the mounds are so big that the ants literally affect the vegetation around them because they don't want it shaded. So in Christmas tree plantations, they can literally kill trees. But the story is, you got to get to the queen. And what I find to be most effective, because you can spray or you can powder the top and it looks like you've got them because the chemicals repel them, and then 3 days later they're active again. What you need to do is take a rod or a stick, something that you can push down into the ant nest, make three or four channels, at least as deep as it can go. And usually that stuff is almost like it's rototilled because the ants have been so active. Mix up whatever. Normal garden insecticides will take care of ants. You just got to get to where you need it. And in this case, as I said, you mix it up. You pour it down into the ground, and so it's getting down to where the queen is. But then you've got this untreated soil on the top that you can cap the top so so nothing else gets exposed. And so it is both the most effective way of doing it, and again, it turns out you're exposing the least amount of non-target critters by working that way.
Okay. And
now, it might take a half a gallon of mix. I mean, if it's a big nest that's 3 feet in diameter, you know, that's been there for years, you might. But smaller nests, as I said, and if it's a real small nest, you know, all you need is a little pipe and just make one hole to get it down there. But it's all about getting it deep enough to really go after the queen.
And then cover it up afterwards.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Sue emailed, and she had big problems in the last 3 years with the viburnum leaf beetle chomping on her native viburnums. Is there any indication that these leaf beetles will be like the Japanese beetles in terms of having few bad years when they first appear, but eventually a much lower numbers? Or is it more likely that these will be a perennial issue and she might be better off just tearing out the viburnums and replacing them with some other type of shrub?
You know, if I look crystal ball it, you know, over time it's going to get better. But what I can't tell her is how long that's going to take. I mean, Japanese beetle, I remember when I used to do radio shows when they were attacking Madison, and you'd explain to people it's like a science fiction movie. There's so many critters out there. And, you know, unless you've experienced it, and I'd live a couple blocks from a golf course, and so, you know, they were coming in just buckets full. Last year, I think I saw 6 Japanese beetles in my garden. That population crashed. That's as dramatic as it can happen. I don't think it's going to come as dramatic with viburnum leaf beetle. It will get better over time. So it's just a question. I think it's worth giving it 3 or 4 years, put up the fight, knock the numbers down as best you can early so that the plant's got a chance to stay healthy, and then see if we start to see the populations drop in. You know, it's natural diseases, it's parasites. I mean, this has been the way of all the invasives that I have been exposed to in my career, that given time, it gets better, but sometimes it takes longer than we'd want it to. So
it can be frustrating, definitely.
Yes.
Which comes up to Mary in Whitewater, and she emailed, and she wants to hear a lot of information about our beneficial bugs, because not everyone's complaints and criticisms about pest bugs. She hears some good news, and let's hear some good news and stop killing bugs. There are so many benefits to insects. I'm sure you agree with her about the benefits of insects, Phil. Can you give her some good bug information?
Well, you know, it's just even statistics. You know, normally we talk about things that we would define as pests, whether they, you know, get in your eyes or eat your plants. It only accounts about 3 to 5% of the insect population. It turns out 2/3 of those are not native, so they're insects that are out of place, and that's why things are kind of out of balance. But all the things that we depend on insects for, whether it's degrading, you know, rotting wood quicker so that it can get recycled, we talk about pollination, we talk about all the beneficial insects that eat pest insects. So again, it's by far a majority, and I think that's the one gratifying thing I've seen over my career, is people's perception of insects have become more tolerant and understanding the balance that is going on out there. And of course, the other side of it are concerns, because insect populations have been in decline. That causes bird populations to go in decline. So, you know, there's a big picture going on here. And definitely, you know, the concept that any insect is not good is not close to being the truth. But there are a few stinkers out there, and those are the ones that unfortunately make it hard to guard.
Right. It gives all the good insects a bad name.
Yeah.
Marion Oconomowoc, in our last couple of minutes here, she emailed and she wants everyone to know that she took your advice about spraying your home and cabin for cluster flies. She does it every year around Labor Day, and it's worked for years. But her question is that those companies that spray yards for mosquitoes, are those sprays really selective, or are they killing all the insects, like good and bad? And thank you for all the great advice over the years.
Sure. They have far more impact. And, you know, the way I explained it to people, if you're going to have your daughter's wedding in your backyard and you want it sprayed to knock the mosquitoes down, that's very appropriate. But if you're spraying repeated numbers of times in a year, you're killing off the beneficial insects. I can literally, you know, argue that you're causing spider mite problems that you would not have if you didn't do the spray. And there are some years, you know, when you contract service, it's so dry, there's no mosquitoes anyway.
Right.
And so, as I said, I'm real hesitant. I understand there are circumstances that it's very appropriate. You know, and our problem is our mosquitoes are blowing in from down the road, so it's not as if you can affect the breeding populations that way. But I'm not a big fan of multiple applications of insecticide for mosquitoes haphazardly. As I said, we do know that it does upset the balance of things over time because these products are not that selective.
Okay, you heard it from the expert, folks. Phil, thank you so much once again for joining us.
Nice to be there.
Okay. Phil Pelletieri is an entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus of UW-Madison. Next up, we're going to talk about the turkey hunting season opener and hear some turkey calls. Let us know why you love turkeys or turkey hunting. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can always send an email to talk@wpr.org.